New York Real Talk with Pamela Sue Mann, Alex Lefchuk, and some incredibly inspiring guest co-presenters from the city that never sleeps via Siren Radio and Southside Broadcasting.
Shirt off the gray and cancel all your plans today, cause it might not be coming back. And though you built this house in heaven's hands and a steel fence strong as Ten Commands, you still roll your road to freedom. Stand above and look beyond. More than everything we depend upon, yeah. We made a mission on the Ferris wheel. Wish until her engines squeal, we'll stay on top forever. But they say life is no amusement park, so before we stroll home after dark, we roll one more ride around. Stand above and look beyond. Roundness in your hand while people swoon in violence. And we were drinking when the towers fell. We were winning when the war was hell. We were singing like cathedral bells.
A truly wonderful and evocative piece of music to actually launch the latest edition of New York Real Talk with, of course, Cathedrals. And we welcome the composer of that particular piece to the program, of course, today, Matt Beck. How are you, Matt?
Very good. Thank you. I believe you are referring to a song, Cathedral Bells, and that is true. By the artist Chris Trapper.
They've had
a lot of input into that track, so that's why
indeed. I chose it. And I have to ask the question, is it an homage, a reflection on 9/11?
You would have to ask the artist that, but I believe it to be so. But I believe it. I believe that he kept it vague enough to sort of make it so that anyone could perhaps project one's own experience into that. So not specifically about 9/11, but I do believe that was playing in his head when he wrote those lyrics.
Well, certainly that's the message that came across to me in terms of the way that the message comes across, really. And it was a kind of postscript to almost
Absolutely, especially that last verse especially really does sort of get a little bit more on the nose with that. But I don't believe that's the whole sentiment. But yeah, definitely a big part of it.
Either way, it's a wonderful way in which music is very much decoded by the listener. And once it's released into the audience, who knows how we decode it? I have to say, hats off to you, obviously, for contributing to that. But let's focus on yourself. So hopefully, Pamela will be joining us as the program proceeds. But what I wanted to actually start off with is why the switch from classical piano to guitar?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I was sort of born into it, both parents being professional classical musicians. It sort of was like a family trade of sorts. So it was logical that I would start, in that realm. But of course, when one becomes a teenager, I started guitar rather late, as a teenager, 15 or 16. As a teenager, you discover one's own music and one's own interests, and you tend to break away and find out, other things that are out there. So I sort of discovered rock and roll, and I discovered pop music, and really, got very into that. And so, as a consequence, guitar made a lot of sense to me at that point,
Well, that
as
makes
opposed to
sense. It's
piano.
always interesting to find out why you choose the instrument. Who knows? You could have actually gone and taken up percussion and done something completely different, but maybe not.
Absolutely. No, you're right. And I'm just glad that I held on to my piano abilities because it served me well as someone who can play guitar and piano and many other instruments. And so I consider myself fortunate to have discovered other styles along the way.
Now, we're really excited that you actually joined us for your debut on New York Real Talk, because, of course, you've worked around the city with a whole range of artists and so on. And I was particularly interested in terms of your work with Lisa Loeb, which we're going to listen to in a few moments, because clearly, I mean, probably best known in many ways for her awesome track, Stay. Which certainly I still sort of play today, and we'll be playing on this very program in all sorts of ways. But
Awesome.
how was it working with Lisa? I mean, is it a case of this is the routine of a jobbing ace musician like myself?
Well, it's interesting. Lisa was the very first artist I ever played with who was an artist of note, let's say. Because I had been busy in New York for a few years at that point, just sort of, grinding away and cutting my teeth and playing with, whoever would have me and sort of just getting out there so I could be heard and meeting people and just sort of trying to be on the scene, and so I started doing, as a consequence of doing all those gigs, I did some of those gigs on guitar, I did some of those gigs on keyboards, and I was very fortunate to meet this bass player named Joe Quigley, and I did a couple gigs with Joe around town, and they were on many different instruments, and he was Lisa Loeb's longtime bass player at that point. And she was about to release her third album at that point called Cake and Pie. And they were looking for a multi-instrumentalist to join the band to go to Japan and tour all over the States and just sort of, be part of the band to promote this third record that was about to come out. And there was a little bit of an audition process from afar because she was in LA at the time and I was in New York. And it worked out. And so I stayed with her for many years and I consider her my first break, if you will, into the world of playing with established artists.
Don't belong, and now that I am leaving, now I know. so sure you try to tell me that I'm clever. That won't take me anyhow or anywhere with you. You said that I was naive, and I thought that I was strong. I thought, hey, I can leave. Oh, but now I know that I was wrong, 'cause I missed you. Me 'cause you want me, and one day you let me go. You try to give away a keeper, or keep me 'cause you know you're just so scared to lose. You say, stay. You say.
We've just been hearing Lisa Loeb and Stay. Have you actually played on her with that particular track?
Live many times. I mean, that's her most known song. And we usually, end the set with that song. Well, maybe not always, but sometimes we'd mix it up. But we'd always play that song, of course. And I played it with her in many different incarnations, like as a duo, as like a trio, as a full band, a quartet, quintet, you know. So I know that song inside and out, and I always loved that song even before I met her.
It's certainly a classic, and will continue to be so as we head through the 21st century. But the reason I thought we'd play it and have just played it is because I thought it tied in very nicely with another musical choice you sent over to us. Because obviously, if you stay, it implies that you're going to wait for something. And I'll Wait for You is another classic, very kind of contemplative number that I felt came across from that side of things. And again, kind of evokes a mood of not melancholy, wistfulness, I would say, perhaps.
Yeah, well, that is one of my songs that I wrote, and of course contributed all the parts to it, like I did with the Chris Trapper song. But this was a song that I wrote, so I can speak a little more in depthly to that. And it's funny, it's absolutely what you're saying. When I wrote it, I had a very specific thing in mind that was happening in my life, but I chose to keep it. Probably maybe for the same reason that Chris Trapper chose to keep his lyrics a little bit more vague. I wanted to keep it a little vague so that perhaps the listener could project into the song, something unique and emotional to them, So it's basically a thought of just stewing and just not being sure about things just sort of being very contemplative. And wistful is a good word, too. Yeah.
Two worlds collide. Another heart beats inside. One goes away, the other holds on to say, I'll wait for you, I'll wait for you, I'll wait for you, I will, I'll wait for you, I'll hoping on another day.
But it is something in literary theory. There's a thing called the death of the author, which basically, once the novel has been released, once the actual writing has gone out into the general public, ultimately the author might have one or two intentions in mind, but it's really up to the audience to decode and deconstruct what they like. Do you think the same thing works in music?
Absolutely. I think that's a direct correlation to music because people have their own experience with songs. I mean, you can talk to five different people and they'll have five very different relationships with the same exact song. In fact, sometimes it's funny to find out what a song was really written about, and say, "Oh, I never realized that. I always thought it was about this, and it's really about a dog or something like that." So I completely believe in that.
For the benefit of the listener, I have to say we're conducting this via the magic of Zoom, and I would be remiss in not commenting on the sign which says Abbey Road towards the back of your good self, known, of course, to many as the legendary home of so many recording artists, including those four lads from Liverpool that you may have heard of back in the day, of course, John, Paul, George, and Ringo. So is that an actual sign? Did you remove it without consent? Is it a case of it's
I don't.
I've got to ask the question now.
I actually did the Abbey Road thing much like everyone else in the world, but completely as a tourist. And I found that, I think, at a nearby store. But yeah, I completely went there as a fan. I happened to be on tour, and I think I had a day off, and I took a little sojourn out there, and
So you went up to the zebra crossing, which has been moved since it was originally sort of
I
filmed in
did
the original,
know
it's not location, et
that,
cetera.
not the actual crossing, right? Too many
Yeah.
people are getting hurt.
Exactly. It's health and safety all the way. And did you go Paul McCartney barefoot, or did you actually go for the full sort of pose across the
I
crossing?
did neither. I did neither. I sort of just sat there very contemplative about the whole thing, rather than trying to act out any fantasy.
I mean, it is intriguing that for a band that very much at the time were being viewed as disposable pop, the legacy that here we are half a century later, still actually reflecting on the shift and the huge shift really from the rock and roll, please please me, love me do, the relative simplicity of that, right the way through to the magnificence of Sergeant Pepper, the more esoteric album songs, and of course the subsequent solo careers of all four
Absolutely.
Musicians. What is it, as a musician yourself, you feel that they managed to encapture? Was it a kind of a magical moment that effectively is a once in a lifetime occurrence, a bit like Mozart, a bit like Beethoven, from the classical sort of pieces, or indeed contemporary stuff, maybe a bit like the next Matt Beck?
I mean, I feel like it's probably the most amazing perfect storm that probably has ever existed in terms of everything that had to be in place for them to have had the career that they had. I mean, of course you need to have these four extremely talented individuals on their own, which is in its own four different miracles that had to take place, and they had to come together. But then, to come together at a time when, the basic model of getting music out there was that you'd have a staff writer write it somewhere, and then they would present it to the artist, and then it would be put out there as product. And the fact that they were able to sort of break that mold of what an artist would be. No, we're going to write our own songs, but and we're going to, just to be able to have that freedom also is another part of that amazing equation, that they were able to sort of, they were able to push the boundaries because no one had done it before. And so they were like, well, even in the studio, why can't we push this fader up? Why can't we push this vocal into distortion? Why can't we, do this? And so, and they were able to do it, and it created a new landscape of sounds for them to pull from and to write from, so that they could go into those, more modern eras.
I certainly think that even today, when we share with music students the notion that Sergeant Pepper was recorded, I believe, on eight tracks or only eight tracks and so on, there's the kind of it's almost one of those mind-blowing things. Although there is an argument for saying that maybe technology has, in a sense, caught up with that the simplicity As I mean, as I say, setting up a home studio is not the preserve of the Mike Oldfields or the multimillionaires and so on. You can effectively create some music again for relatively inexpensive notions from that point of view. Although we still, as I say, hearken back to some of the classics. So I've got to ask the question, Matt, what is your favorite Beatles number?
Song? Or, I mean, God, most people ask for favorite album. To pick a favorite song is wow, I couldn't even imagine. I couldn't even imagine.
Let's do the Desert Island Discs thing. Let's just say that you effectively are stranded on a desert island and we actually allow you to have, okay, I'll be generous, three Beatles songs that you can actually take with you on your portable player to actually sort of see you through this time on a desert island. Which three would you go for?
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I'm going to go off. I'll go off. I'll start with one that's just a little off the beaten path. My favorite record is Revolver for sure. I'm going to go with She Said. I've always loved that song, and I just love the sound of it, and I love everything about that song. So that's always been a personal favorite that's not, you know, necessarily a fan favorite per se, you know. Be one for sure. I almost, another one that falls under that category would be Tomorrow Never Knows, but that's off the same album, and I feel like it's
an interesting you've gone for a George Harrison number there, and I think again a really classic sort of take on that sort of things there. And again, it opens up a whole range of mind expanding aspects before they even trying mind expanding aspects, really.
Yeah.
Lay down all thoughts, surrender to the void.
I mean, God, I guess third would have, I'd have to pick something classic. Anything
I mean,
on
if it
Soft
helps,
Shore.
I've always had a fondness for The Fool on the Hill or Nowhere Man. Probably it's just a personal thing, basically, but
Absolutely. I mean, those are perfect songs. I mean, they're perfect songs. I don't know. I would have to pick. I pick all of Sergeant Pepper. I'm breaking the rules.
I'll let you go with that, but we'll listen to She Said.
Yeah, we'll just listen
It's
to
Do
it.
Your Real Talk, and
Sorry.
we're talking to ace guitarist Matt Beck, a musician extraordinaire, and the focus is very much with your good self, Matt, today. I'm normally this is the point where Pamela actually asks for a wacky New York moment, but she asks it in such a way that it's almost irrepeatable. But I will actually sort of channel it into the whole system insofar as would you consider yourself a New Yorker in terms of your focus on the whole system, or would you say whether you're still a visitor in New York in the Big Apple itself?
I think I'm definitely a New Yorker. I mean, I was born in the Bronx at Albert Einstein Hospital, and I was raised in Westchester, which is just north of New York City, a suburb, if you will.
Home of the
I've never,
X-Men, I believe.
yes, but always a commutable distance to the city. So when I was a kid, I grew up seeing shows at Madison Square Garden and the Beacon Theater, and all those great venues. And as soon as I was old enough and already making a living, I decided that I should be in the city, and that was well over 20 years ago now. So
I think that qualifies you as a
I'm
genuine New Yorker.
yeah, I've
Yeah,
never
I
lived
think
anywhere else outside of the state. So.
makes sense. Okay, let's talk Matchbox 20. Again, a great band, a great guitar band from that point of view. 3 AM is a personal favorite from my own perspective. Was it just a case of Rob Thomas decides one day he needs a musical director and you are the sole person, basically, you're the only choice, really. If you'd said no, the probably the Matchbox 20 would have collapsed, really.
Well, it's interesting. There are two camps there because there's Matchbox 20, who I play with and have now for almost 20 years, and then there's Rob Thomas's solo career. So I am the musical director of his solo band, and so while I was still playing with Matchbox on one of the tours, Rob took me aside and said, "Hey, I'm starting this solo venture, and I would love to have you there as my right-hand man. Help me put together the band. Help me get this off the ground and help me, keep control of it." And I said, "Of course." And so that was well over 10 years ago. So I've been doing both things. I've been, as Rob goes back and forth between the two worlds, so do I. And so he basically had already was very familiar with me as a musician and what I could do from playing already in a couple of years with Matchbox 20 with him. And so for him, I guess it was a logical choice to ask me if I
It
would
was the
be.
only choice, let's face it. I mean,
Yeah, I mean,
surely it's
because
a.
we're together on the road and spending many hours together, long months and weeks together. So yeah, I think he thought, Matt would be a good choice to help me do this.
And
So
you've raised another interesting point there, which brings us around to that other classic line, which is studio versus performance live or live performance. Do you have a preference, or is it a case of whatever?
I mean, I guess it's the answer is whatever, but not because I don't care. I mean, I equally love both as well, and I think they're both extremely important things, art forms even. So God, I would hate to have one without the other. But of course, you do one for too long and you start pining for the other. So I mean, they're two very different things, even though sometimes you're playing the same material. The normal cycle is you get together in the studio and you put these songs together and you put them up on the screen, you create the arrangements, and then down the road a little you have the task of like making these work in a live situation in real time instead of recorded over a long period of time. And that's a whole wonder other wonderful beautiful task to take on. So God, it would be really hard to choose between the two because they really are two very different things and would hate to have one without the other. But they really are two very distinctly different things.
We've just had the news in Britain that for the first time, I think, in several decades, the top 10 best-selling singles last year were all by British artists, including the likes of Kate Bush, who obviously had a big boost for Running Up the Hill, thanks to Stranger Things, etc. Ed Sheeran obviously appearing within that side of things, etc. You, of course, were handpicked to join Rod Stewart and his band for the Still the Same tour from that point of view. Interesting, when I saw Still the Same, I thought that was a Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band number called Still the Same. Has Rod adapted it, or is it a different line?
Yeah. That was an amazing time, and that was something that just fell into my lap. I have a very good friend who was playing bass in the band at the time, Conrad Korsch, and when they were looking to do this tour for Still the Same, now you know Rod is very well known for doing covers. You know, as you know, a lot of his hits are cover songs, you know. And so, you know, he had just finished many years of doing those jazz standards. I think, you know, he had maybe four albums, Standards 1, Standards 2, 3, and 4. And this was 2007. And so this was his big return back to rock and roll. And so what he decided to do was take the model of those jazz standards records and apply it to rock. So let me take some great standard rock songs and do my take on them. And so one of the songs on that album was Still the Same, and I guess he decided to go with that for the title. But I did that for almost 2 years, just off that album, and played stadiums and all over Europe, which I'd never done before.
I have to ask the question, Matt. Did Rod still actually keep up his penchant for kicking footballs into the audience?
Yes,
and following football in general, or soccer, as you'd refer to it.
Right. Yes, he did. I mean, he even had his team, you know, was on the logo, because we were in the round for the arena. The stadiums couldn't really do in the round, but all the arenas we did was in the round, and he had a circular stage in the middle, and then we were in another circular stage around him, and he had the logo of his football team on there. So yeah, and always every night he kicked the balls.
I think if memory serves, he's a Glasgow Celtic fan. I know he's a Scotland fan internationally, but it's Glasgow Celtic, the keen sort of folk that he actually goes for. Unlike, of course, Elton John, who was a major follower of Watford, which is a completely different sort of football team from that point of view. So again, next question, Matt. Do you follow soccer, or is it a case of, no, for goodness sake, so just step away from that completely?
I just don't know anything about it. I'm not really a sports guy. I've been so steeped in music. I grew up as a tennis kid. So if you want to talk tennis, we can talk that. But football is not anything I know.
You could argue that Jimmy Connors and John McEnroe were the first rock and roll tennis players in many ways.
And you know, I met Jimmy Connors because he came to a Rob Thomas show twice. He's come. And John McEnroe has sat in with Rob Thomas. You can actually find it on YouTube. We did Purple Haze at the Beacon Theater. So John always comes around when we're playing New York, and he'll hang out and sit in.
See, that's the kind of classic thing. That's why I've got to ask the question. Was there ever a temptation to actually say to Rod Stewart, Rod, have you considered doing a version of Miley Cyrus's Wrecking Ball? I'm just saying.
You know, sometimes, you know, more times than not, he would, after the show was done, he'd just be whisked away into his jet and I'll see you at the next show. But there were certain occasions where he would stay, and he would invite the band out, and we would have our time to sort of hang out. You know, he'd have the corner of a bar and we'd all be there. And, you know, after a couple of drinks, you could really ask him anything. And he was all, you know, I remember sitting down and sort of slapping him on the knee and saying, so what's the deal with you and Jeff Beck? How come you guys don't get along? You know, what's the story?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and, I'll tell you. You want to know? I'll tell you. You know, yeah. Yeah. Another Roman Coke. Okay, come on. You know, those were the moments, though, that you live for, because, you know, he liked being around musicians as much as we liked being around him, the great singer that he is. And he's lived such a great life in the rock and roll, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's something which the longevity of, obviously there are folk who will still remember his cover, his versions of Maggie May, for instance, his time with the Small Faces, the whole aspect with respect to that, Sailing, and of course his other changes, etc. And he still, a bit like David Bowie to a certain extent, reinvents, but at the same time maintains the quality from that perspective. And would that be your advice, Matt, for any young artists, any young musicians who might be listening to this, who are thinking, how can I have the kind of longevity that Matt Beck shown to work through the whole process? What's the secret, Matt? What do I go for?
Well, I think the secret is aligning yourself with artists that are that long lasting as well. Seriously, probably being as versatile as you can, because there's not a lot of people can necessarily go from like a Lisa Loeb band to Matchbox 20 to Rod Stewart. It's a different slightly different skill sets. It's all within pop music, but Lisa's a little folkier. Matchbox is a little more classic rock, a little more 70s influence classic rock, and then with Rod you've got the whole soul influence and R&B influence in his it's rock, but if you're not able to groove, you're not going to be in that band. You've got to really have pocket. So I think being versatile is key. Also, I play a lot of instruments. Like with each of those bands I mentioned, I was a multi-instrumentalist in those bands. Guitar, keyboards, mandolin, pedal steel, dobro, all the different instruments that are related to strings and keys.
And ultimately, of course, it's good that we still actually have that input of humanity, as opposed to saying, oh, we'll just program it on the computer. Because I think for a number of years, there was a suggestion that why do we actually need to have good backing musicians and so on? We could just put it into the machine. And it's never quite the same, is it, really?
I mean, I think the proof is in, if you go look at a performance when someone comes out and it's completely, they're singing to everything's on track. I think it works in like a hip hop kind of thing, because you usually have a DJ at least who's being creative with the pre-recorded music.
Yeah.
Maybe it works better in that instance, but even still, when I see a hip hop band with a live band, it always is a little more, to me, a little more proven. It's a little more musical.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, this is more Midweek Drive than New York Real Talk, although we are focusing on New York. I suspect Pamela's got lost somewhere in cyberspace. It is actually the first ever New York Real Talk she ever has not managed to connect with us. So it's curious, but still, hopefully all is well. Let's move on to considering Broadway shows, specifically Spider-Man, The Last Ship, and Beautiful. Now, Spider-Man I was unaware that Bono and The Edge, of course, known for U2, had ever got involved with the Marvel Universe, or is it a completely different kind of Spider-Man?
No, it's the Spider-Man.
Peter Parker.
They were signed on to do it. That was the plan all along, is that Julie Taymor, who's a big director, did Lion King and Across the Universe movie. This was her big, foray into having a show where she wrote the book as well and directed and was just involved with every aspect of it. First of all, for me as a musician in New York City, the Broadway thing is very unique to New York City. And if you're a working musician, that there's a lot of opportunities there if you have the skills. Mainly like reading music and following a conductor and all the, those kinds of skills. Now that it's, how long has musical theater been around as an art form? You don't have, it's not all Gershwin. It's not all, Cole Porter. You've got rock stars now that are, of age, and the theater going age is, these are fans of rock and roll. And so it's why you see so many more shows being written by rock stars and pop stars, and it's logical. So someone like me who's played with a lot of established artists and stars like that, I get a lot of those calls, which is why most of the shows I've done are not in the traditional form, old school form. They're like rock operas and these kinds of pop musicals. To be able to work with Bono and Edge and Sting, Carole King was not actually part of Beautiful, but the show is all about her life and her.
Inevitably, we come around to shows such as obviously Benny and Bjorn and the construction of Chess, the ABBA scenarios. You can even go back to, there's an argument for saying that even original opera, Così fan tutte and so on, actually was kind of rock opera of its time, really, and the musical form changes and evolves and metamorphoses, which is fascinating. I won't ask you to name a favorite between Beautiful, The Ship, or Spider-Man, but you could always say something like, well, I still haven't found what I'm looking for, if you wanted to give us a hint in terms of, you know, where you're going through. But that's by the by.
That's funny. I mean, there's no way that I could choose between Bono and the Edge and Sting. I mean, those are, I don't think it gets any bigger than those people, you know. So getting a chance to work intimately with them on music was just unbelievable. One of the highlights.
Yeah, I mean, one was an Englishman in New York, the other one were two Irishmen in New York. So we come back to Jerry Leonard and various other areas. Which brings us neatly right to the fact, have you worked with Jerry and Pamela?
I have never worked with Jerry directly, per se. We've tag teamed a few records together. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if Jerry is aware of this, because I've only met Jerry a few times. Delightful, but I've been a fan of his work for a long time. We actually played on a few records together, not all at the same time. And we've played with some artists, some of the same artists, but not at the same time. Yeah.
I met Pamela
sort of recently. Actually, I was doing some shows with the B-52s, and Jerry and Pamela and family came to the show, and so I got to hang out with them afterwards, and we all had a nice chat. Nice to get to know them.
It's just like New York City is one big love shack, basically. But that's, again, that's a good crossover from that point of view. Oh, there's so many things we're dropping in here. We're going out, of course, with It's Only Love, which of course takes us around from Love Shack, etc., to the whole essence of that. And again, is this one of yours, or is this something where you
this thought? This is a song. I chose this song because this is a one of a proper co-write between me and Rob Thomas. We've written a few songs together over the years, but this is the first one to make it onto the record. So it was significant to me because of that. Rob did write all the lyrics, but the song came from something that I had been working on that I had shown him that he liked. And so together we put that together.
We'll be asking you to introduce it in a few moments from now, but let's move on to a couple of other sort of closing things at this particular stage. In terms of the way that the music industry is developing, the way it's evolving, the way it's changing, and so on. Obviously, I think a lot of folk were focused on the COVID era, homework, things were actually changing. Do you maintain that ultimately we're in a good phase here? We're actually in a good optimistic mode, and that actually music is evolving and it's coming through? Or are you more of a the glass is half empty person?
I mean, I feel like no matter what, I mean, it's all positive, because there's no alternative to life. It's like what has happened has happened.
So I mean, look how many times they had to vote for Kevin McCarthy just to become Speaker of the House. Exactly.
Right. Exactly. But I mean, you know, listen, we were in the throes of this pandemic. So, you know, of course, you know, people want to create. So, of course, other opportunities are going to arise. And so that is a positive thing. It came from a negative thing. I wish that negative thing hadn't have happened. But it has given birth to other mediums and ways that we can get work done. You know, so for me, I tend to be a bit optimistic in that way. I mean, I'm not happy that there was a pandemic and it was a very hard thing to get through. But some things came out of it that we never thought, you know, could be this way. And now, you know, it's sort of, now that things are sort of getting back to a semblance of what was, a lot of these things have maintained. I mean, the fact that we're doing this, I still am doing sessions from home because some clients are like, you know, that worked well for me. Can we keep doing that? I said, of course, send me the tracks, and that's good.
And the magic, of course, it also reduces our carbon footprint as well to a certain extent. So that's all good. It's sustainable. Matt, it's been terrific connecting with you yourself today. We've got two final questions, which I will put in the midweek drive manner. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been okay for you?
Oh, this has been fantastic. I you know, Pamela told me about this, and you know, of course, you never know really what to expect, but you're delightful, and it's been a pleasure talking to you, so thank you.
Well, thank you, Matt. I have to say, normally for New York Real Talk, we normally have two or three other co-hosts and co-presenters. I don't know what's happened to them, but I have to ask the question, how do people follow you on the socials? Is it mattbeckmusic.com? Do you have Instagram? Do you have TikTok? What's the best way of following your work?
Well, I do have a website, mattbeckmusic.com, although it's brand new, so it needs to be updated or needs to be finished. But the best way is probably Facebook, and Instagram. So on Facebook, I'm mattbeck20, all spelled out, T-W-E-N-T-Y. And on Instagram, I'm Matty May, M-A-T-T-Y. Oh, no, I'm sorry, it's the same. It's mattbeck20, spelled out, M-A-T-T-B-E-C-K-T-W-E-N-T-Y.
You're out there. That's the important thing. So the final question is, will you be kind enough to return, hopefully, when Pamela will be back with New York Real Talk and join us again in the not-too-distant future? Will you come back for us another time, please?
Anytime.
Brilliant. But the final task, basically, because the normal response with Pamela is, I ask her, what is New York, the home of the world's finest? And she says, home of the world's finest pickle. It's bizarre, but I will actually ask you, rather than talking about that, would you like to introduce yourself with the final number that we're going to hear from today's package? Of course, it's Only Love. Over to you, Matt.
This is Matt Beck, and this is a song called It's Only Love by Rob Plumb.
Call off the dawn. Cause I'm wide awake and can't seem to move on. I can't be alone with myself and I can't find the way on my own. And I'm not the kind to be scared of an ending. I know that we're all that we've lost. And I'm not the one to hold on to the memory. Could tear us apart. It's only love. It's hard to believe when it's said and done. You cry when you think that you've had enough. It's only love. I lie and I wait. I'm scared of the thought of facing a new day. I can't see the end in my head, but I know that it starts out this way.